Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. You can find information on this specific subtype or your subtype, as well as all our podcast episodes on SFA's website, www.curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Thanks for listening. SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners, to amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients. SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link. On this episode, we speak with Margaret Livermore, who is a member of SFA's Public Policy Committee and a strong advocate for the sarcoma community. Margaret received her initial diagnosis of leiomyosarcoma in Jamaica in 2002. 16 years later, it returned. As Margaret takes us through her sarcoma journey, she shares about the importance of self-advocacy in informed decision-making and providing support to others who are in a similar position to her. We also talk about systemic inequities that minority patients often face within the medical system and how that can create mistrust when receiving care, as well as increased barriers to that care. This is a necessary conversation we need to continue having in the sarcoma community to ensure all patients have access to care. Thank you so much, Margaret, for the genuine and authentic conversation. We are so deeply appreciative of your openness and honesty. Let's dive into the podcast. Welcome back to Sarcoma Stories, or if this is your first time listening, welcome to Sarcoma Stories. I'm Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
And I'm Brandy. I'm your other host.
And today we are talking with Margaret Livermore. Margaret, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Margaret. I'm a mother of two, grandmother of five, and basically a happy person.
Margaret's a very happy person. Our audience can't see this. She's wearing a very bright yellow blouse, just the most cheerful face. So Margaret's bringing the sunshine today. Margaret, we're so excited to be here with you today and to talk with you about your sarcoma journey. So to begin, do you want to tell us about how you were diagnosed with sarcoma, how this whole journey began?
Okay. So my story is a little bit weird. It started out like most people with uterine leiomyosarcoma, where you have fibroids and you're diagnosed with fibroids and you treat everything as fibroids. So in 2002, I was living in Jamaica at the time. I was having complications from it, like severe pain and heavy periods, et cetera. Long story short, I had a myomectomy. This was at the end of December, literally, the 28th of December. I remember it because everybody was like, why would you do it after Christmas? I don't do pain if I can help it. So that's why I chose that day. Yeah, because I was having extreme pain. So when the pathology report came back, my doctor called me in to say, we have something that's rare that they think, you know, this is what you have. It's a rare cancer called leiomyosarcoma. I think you may have been overdiagnosed because we only see this in older patients, mostly Caucasians. So let's get a second opinion. Got the second opinion. They said, yes, we do see abnormal growth. So something was definitely there, but I think the surgery that you had was enough. The initial doctor was suggesting full hysterectomy and chemotherapy. Wasn't comfortable with the conflict of the two. So my cousin in New York decided to contact the doctor and we sent the slides over and they said yes. There was some abnormality, but I think the surgery took care of it as well. Surgery is the best bet, so we'll just do 6-month scans. Fast forward, I came back to the U.S. A few months later. I had 1 6-month scan. My doctor died, my primary care doctor, and I just forgot about it. Literally forgot about it. In 2016, 2017, I started having a lot of weird symptoms. And my doctor kept sending me to specialists, and they kept saying, "You're fine. We don't see anything wrong." Eventually, he thought I was a hypochondriac because he started to offer me medication. But I wouldn't take it because I knew nothing was wrong with my mind. I knew something was wrong with my body. After a while, it got so bad that they started to find microscopic blood in my urine, and they couldn't figure out where it was from. Urologists eventually said, "We see veins popping on your bladder. Don't know why." And then I fainted and ended up in the hospital for a week. They did everything. All the previous things that I'd done, I got every scan you can think of. But they couldn't find anything wrong. I had fibroids again. Still didn't send off an alarm bell because I'd forgotten about the sarcoma. So one of the doctors that came in said to me, "I don't know what they're going to tell you, but to me, it looks like you have cancer. I think you should go and see an oncologist." And that's what I did. Got there. I said to him, "This is what the doctor said." Did an ultrasound. He said, "I see cancer every day." He's a gynecology oncologist. "And this doesn't look like cancer to me. It looks like your fibroids are degenerating." I said, "I don't care. We're getting the uterus out. That's it. I don't need it." During the surgery, he sent someone to tell my sister that they found cancer and told her the name of it. And that's how it came. That's what was my first recurrence. I've since had 4 recurrences.
So let me, just to be clear for all the listeners, you were originally diagnosed in 2002, had surgery and thought, nothing else is needed. I'm going to be fine. And then 16 years later, you had a recurrence.
Correct.
Margaret, was that first surgery in Jamaica where you were originally diagnosed?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
The good thing about the Jamaica surgery was that they didn't have the laparoscopic thing at that time. So it was a regular, I don't remember what they call that, where they cut you like the C-section part. Yeah. So everything had just come out. I was even able to see it. They brought the thing in a jar to show me. But they didn't realize it was a tumor. They just thought it was a regular fibroid.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was able to see it. In 2018, when I did the surgery, I had laparoscopic surgery. Uh-huh. So, you know, they did the marcellation kind of thing. And that's how I learned that that's something that you should avoid if you possibly can.
Interesting.
Okay. But at that time, there was no discussion that, hey, I had this previously. We should be looking at it in case a little bit more closely, in case it could be a recurrence. That wasn't part of the discussion.
I had completely forgotten about it. I only remembered when the doctor came and said to me, "This is your diagnosis." And when I said it, the surgeon was actually really mad at me because he's like, "How could you forget something like that?" But I'm like, it's been 16 years I've been living my life. I'd had another fibroid previous to that in 2007, had an ablation. Mm-hmm. Didn't even remember it then. Had an ablation and was fine until 2016, 2017, when I started having problems again.
And I just want to clarify, in the beginning, when they took what they thought was a fibroid out, was there mention at that point that this was a sarcoma?
No. It was after they got the pathology report that they mentioned sarcoma.
Okay. Interesting. And so for those 16 years before you have your first recurrence, are they following you and they're, or no? So you're just...
No, because I didn't tell anybody. I told my initial doctor when I got back here, I told him, and he sent me for a scan 6 months later, and then he died, and then I got a new doctor. I just didn't remember. I don't know if it was my mind just shutting it away or what, but I just literally did not remember.
So then you have your recurrence, and they do the hysterectomy. And what happens from there?
Okay, so I had 4 cycles of Gemtax and Neulasta.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I was happy again, super happy, because as far as I was concerned, I am good, because they'd gotten everything. So I didn't even want to do the chemo. I really didn't want to do it, because I didn't want to feel as exhausted as I'd felt before. I was so weak and tired. And then literally about 3 days after the surgery, I felt like I could walk a marathon. So I didn't want to go back to that feeling. And I knew that's what the chemo entailed. But I went and got 3 different opinions. And they said, we think this is the best course of action. So I did that.
What prompted you to get multiple opinions?
For all the doctors that are listening, especially the ones I love, I apologize in advance. But I've never trusted doctors. So I've always been a skeptic when it came to doctors.
I think that's important, though. I think trust is important when you are talking about your health. It's your health. You know your body. For patients to feel heard and seen, there does need to be trust created.
Yes, definitely. I agree with you on that.
So after you got the chemotherapy and the surgery, did the doctor say, we're going to do scans every so often? And
yes. I was told 3-month scans for 2 years. I had 3-month scans for 1.5 years. My doctor left the hospital and the new doctor said, well, you're fine. So let's do 6-month scans. So he canceled the 3-month scans. And I think that was short-sighted, because when I went back for the 6-month scan, there was another recurrence.
Mm.
And I had multiple lesions.
Mm.
I was a little upset, to be quite honest. I was a little angry, because I was like, if you had just continued with the protocol, then we would have found it quicker. That's not necessarily true, but that's where my mind went. So I was a little angry. They found 2 lesions in my pelvic area, literally around the same area that the initial one was.
Mm.
They saw some tiny nodules, but they were not sure if the nodules on my lungs were actually cancerous or if it was just from a previous infection or something. So they started checking those as well.
So what did you do from there?
I had another surgery. And the doctor that I had it with said to me after the surgery, when I went back for my checkup, that he wasn't able to put the markers in, because he found that the tumor, the main one, was attached to spindle-looking things, and they were attached to different places. And when he clipped, it just retracted like a rubber band, and he wasn't able to specifically put markers in. And then he suggested that I do radiation. And I decided that I didn't want to do it. Again, I got a second opinion. The doctor with the second opinion said, I think it may be a good idea. I would go with him. I got a third opinion. I went to my previous hematology oncologist, but she left the place. So I found her. I asked her what she thought. I gave her my opinion on what I thought. And she said to me, Margaret, I think you're on the right track. And she said something to me that caused me to do the work that I'm doing now. She said, I think you should teach other people how to advocate for themselves. So what I said to them was, if you don't know where this thing was, what are you going to radiate? Are you going to do the entire pelvis and then damage organs that are healthy? Or what are you going to do? And he said, well, we'd have to do the entire pelvis. And I said, no, thank you. I said, what I'll do is we'll do the scans. And if it comes back, then we know what we're doing. He suggested chemo, and I refused that as well. I said, I would prefer to watch and see what happens. But I kept going back to the fact that it had been 16 years since the first recurrence. So I held on to that as a beacon of hope. We did that. And then, so that was in 2020. And by 2021, it came back. So then they said, sorry, we can't do, it came back quickly. I think within like maybe 8 to 10 months, they said, we can't do another surgery. It's too soon. And because of where it is as well, it's difficult because this spine, it's attaching itself to my blood. And my urethra, and it had grown big, so big really quick. So they said, we don't think it's a good idea to do surgery. Let's do chemo again. So this time it was doxorubicin and dacarbazine. Did two cycles. Didn't work for me. It grew quite a bit, and I had new growth within that two cycles. Also, it gave me heart issues. The first time it happened, they said to me, this is a new drug. Let's see what happens. Let's see if it settles down. The second time, I literally couldn't do it anymore. And then when they did the scans, it showed that there was growth. So we went back to the GemTabs. When we went back to the GemTabs, it didn't show any improvement after two cycles. And they went to the tumor board and they decided that they were going to talk about trying other treatment options. And for some reason, my doctor, she thought about it and she called me back and she said, you know, Margaret, it didn't grow. It didn't progress, but it didn't shrink either. So she said, how would you feel about trying another two cycles? And I'm like, I'm on board. And after we did the next two cycles, we saw some little shrinkage. And I was super happy. It was supposed to be six cycles. We ended up doing eight. She asked me if I would be willing to try an extra two. She was very detailed. She's like, Margaret, this is not normal. We know it's been tough on your body already. It's going to be tough. You have to think about it. Don't just say yes. I want you to think about it and get back to me. I thought about it and I'm like, yep. If this means that I'm going to get rid of this thing, then I'm open to it. So that's what I did.
That sounds like a shared decision-making with you and your doctor, having that conversation to arrive at that together instead of just saying, this is what you must do. It's your body. It's your choice, how you want to move forward.
So we did the eight cycles and then we started doing just gemcitabine for three cycles as maintenance chemo. Then I started having pain again, like really, really bad pain. And I was exhausted. I was just sleeping away, like literally would sleep the entire day if someone didn't wake me up. And I went to the hospital and they did some scans and they found that I was diagnosed with diverticulitis already and it was inflamed. And we're going to do surgery again for the diverticulitis. And they noticed that a part of my colon was infected or looked infected, my sigmoid colon. So we were doing surgery for that. And when we did the surgery, the doctor said to me, when he took it out, it felt like concrete. It was just really, really hard. And so I lost a part of my colon there.
All total, how many surgeries have you had? It seems like it's been one after another after another.
I had five surgeries in between 2018 and 2023.
Wow.
Four of them were to remove tumors and one the colon.
So where are you today in terms of treatment?
I'm doing 3-month scans still. because I had my last surgery in October of 2023. That was the first time I heard clear margins. So very positive about that. And I have one due next month.
Well, that's good news.
Yes.
That's good news.
Very hopeful.
That's a long journey and a lot on your body.
I kept having a really, really bad pain in this shoulder. And they did scans, they did ultrasounds, CT scans, and everybody kept saying, there's nothing wrong with your shoulder. We don't see anything wrong. It's probably muscular. Long story short, one of the times I went to do my scans and I couldn't lift my arm. But I've been having that problem. And I kept telling them, but they were not listening. So when that happened at the hospital, when I couldn't lift my arm, then they decided to do an MRI. And they found that I had a torn rotator cuff and a lot of damage. So the doctor said to me, what sports do you play? Are you a tennis player? I'm like, I play no sports. It was the chemo that had damaged. And I am still struggling with a couple of things. I have neuropathy. Sometimes I'm good. And then one day it just attacks me, my hands and my feet. I have an incisional hernia from the last surgery. And that's a little stressful, but the bigger stress is that a part of my abdomen near the surgical area, right down there, opens up and bleeds at the slightest thing. If I exercise, even if I walk, I'm a walker. If I walk, give me a couple of days and it starts to bleed. If I lift anything, I would say over 5 pounds, literally, give me a couple of days and I start to feel the soreness and then it starts to bleed. And I've seen 3 doctors and none of them will do surgery on it because they say because of where it is. I'm sorry, I feel like every time I talk about this, I get very emotional.
It is very emotional.
This part is really hard because every time something happens, I can set a goal. I can say, if I do the surgery, if I do 8 cycles of chemo, then I have something to look forward to. With this, they're telling me they can't do anything because of where it is, it's literally on my pelvic bone, the hernia. And then it's right next to it that the thing opens up the wound. A wound specialist said to me that he thinks a piece of suture was left in there. And it is what, whenever I move too much, it's trying to come out, but it's stuck. And how they would normally treat that is cut it open, clean it out, and allow it to heal properly. Because it heals on the outside, but it's not healing inside. And, but none of the surgeons want to do it because of how near it is to the hernia. And they're afraid that it will cause more damage than good. But I worry constantly because I'm worried about it getting infected. And then once it gets infected, then this is going to be a huge deal for me. It got infected last month, but because I'm so careful, I pay attention, serious attention to everything. I was able to catch it before it got really bad. And I was able to get antibiotic ointments and medicine, which helped. But I still struggle with that. Sometimes, literally every month, I have to deal with this. I don't really talk about it to people because it feels very, it doesn't seem like a big deal in the grand scheme of all the things that have happened, but it's really stressful to live with.
To every month have to take time to deal with this, that is a big interruption. I feel like I hear survivors oftentimes not want to talk about these things because they want to remind everyone that they're grateful to be alive. And like you said, in the grand scheme of things, okay, maybe this isn't the same as a surgery or a chemo, but this is still a big deal. And I'm glad you brought that up because you have to allow yourself permission sometimes to say, this is a hard thing that I deal with as an outcome of the treatments that I had to keep me alive.
Yes, yes.
Margaret, I want to talk a little bit about your self-advocacy. Your self-advocacy is admirable, not just shared decision-making, but advocating for yourself and what's right for you. And that's really important with patients to make the decisions that's right for them. It may not be a decision that someone else would make, and that's okay. Everybody is individual and how what they want to go through and what they don't want to go through. And I know now you're using your journey to help other people. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. So in 2018, when I was going through chemo, I had an allergic reaction to the dexamethasone. And I noticed dexamethasone because the second time I was having the chemo, the nurse decided to do the each drug individually to see what I would react to. And I as it touched my vein, I literally jumped out the chair because it burned. It felt like it was burning. So I know that's what it is. A lot of doctors refuse to accept it, but I know because I was there. My breasts, under my breasts, on top of my breasts, my stomach, my legs, the back of my legs, my thighs, broke out in a really, really bad rash. It was initially just like tiny, tiny rashes like measles, but then it started to get red. And then it started to burn. It itched, but it started to burn. And if I put my hand over it, you could feel the heat coming out of it. And then it just looked like third-degree burns after a while. I went to an allergist, yeah. And she gave me some ointments and stuff, but it didn't help. So the center that I was getting my treatment at, they sent me to their dermatologist. And he gave me a shot. And he gave me two different medicines to take. And that helped. But what actually was the thing that helped me even emotionally and mentally was I reached out to their Fourth Angel Network and got someone who kind of matched my diagnosis and everything. She had the rash as well, but she didn't have it on so many different parts of her body. So she was able to say, yes, well, I did ice and I did this and I did that. And I just want to give my little granddaughter a shout out. She was like 8 or 9 at the time. She actually suggested ice and would bring ice to me and put it on my body. Yes. So when the lady said, you know, I used ice and it helped. And after talking to her, I realized, oh, so this is someone who actually literally knows what I'm going through. Mm. And she would talk to me weekly and I would talk and she would give me advice on different things and how to handle emotional situations. And I decided I was going to do that too. So after my treatment, I signed up, did the course, and I've been mentoring for the Fourth Angel Network since. I also, because people know, I don't hide my journey. At the time, I didn't publicize it at all, but because people knew, they would send people to me. So I would just have random people who have different cancers who would call and say, I know someone. Can you talk to them? So I did that.
When you say you didn't publicize it so much, is there a reason that you didn't?
There is a reason. And I think most cancer survivors will tell you this. The real reason I didn't publicize it is because I was afraid of the judgment. And when I say judgment, I don't mean that people want to judge me in a bad way, but they look at you different when you have cancer. Like they expect you to die and they treat you like you're dying. Some people disappear. I lost friends who I was friends with for over 40 years. Some people just disappear. Some are still there, but they're on the periphery of your life. They just, oh, I'm just checking on you. Just want to see how you're doing. But they're not there, and you feel the disconnect. So in terms of trying to keep it secret, and at work as well, I didn't want people at work to treat me different and look at me different. And I did have that in 2020. I actually feel like I lost my job because of that. It happens to people every day. We just don't talk about it. So the company I was working for was sold to one of our huge competitors, and I was kept on. I was a content writer. At the time, I was their content marketing manager. I lost my sister in 2019 to triple negative breast cancer. And we were very close, almost like twins. People didn't call one name without the other. So that was traumatic. Days before I went to her funeral, I had someone just, an F-250 just crashed into the back of my car at a traffic light. So my head was just a mess, literally. So I got a new box and I was very open with her. Didn't hide it. I was like, this is what is happening. My brain is fuzzy. I'm not focusing very well. Seeing doctors. I'm also doing work myself to get my brain to work how it normally works. I saw a neurologist who told me that even though I'm having issues, that I was still competent to do my work. And she did everything in her power to get rid of me. Everything. And I'm not just saying that. Some of our colleagues came to me and commiserated, like, I'm so sorry this is happening to you. But to be fair to her, she didn't know me because she was new. She didn't know my work. And sometimes people see you and you're a little bit different. And they think you're just lazy. And it doesn't matter what you do. She did things to like embarrass me in front of the team. Like literally, where people looked like they were uncomfortable. And after a while, HR called me and they said to me, Margaret, really sorry to have to do this, but your boss says it's not working out with you and her. We're going to suggest a soft landing for you. You can take short-term disability or we can fire you right now. Those were my options. So I took the disability. It ended up being long-term because after that, I had my second, third recurrence. And it just went downhill from there because that was so stressful to me. Because my job was something that I used as one of my tools to navigate the cancer. Because when I got to work, I forgot about everything. It was all about the work.
It gave you something to think, something else to focus on.
Yes.
So normal.
Literally. Because I would have to do research before I could write my stuff that I had to write. I wrote white papers for different members of staff, like the C-suite, wrote blogs for them. And it was a software company. So I had to dig deep and research and talk to people. So it took my mind off of what I was dealing with until I left the building.
Mm-hmm. Are you still on long-term disability?
Yes, I'm on long-term disability still.
How long did you work for that company?
From 2014 to 2020. So about 6 years.
Wow.
Oh. I had two recurrences while working. In 2018, when I was diagnosed, owner of the company, he was amazing. He allowed me to come in when I wanted to come in or work from home when I wanted to work from home. Because he knew my work. He knew that I was not a slacker. He knew that I would get my work done. So he gave me free range to work how I wanted and when I wanted. So if I could work at midnight, I worked at midnight. Mm-hmm. But my work was always done and always on time.
Yeah, that flexibility is so important when you are navigating a diagnosis. You don't know when you're going to feel okay and so when you're going to have time. And like you said, your work was getting done, just maybe not in the conventional hours.
Wow. So we're circling back. We talked about your self-advocacy and how important that was for you, but I think it's also a great example for others. Were there any tools or resources you used throughout that process to track what you were going through, collect information, to be able to ask questions? What resources did you use for yourself?
Etienne, first thing I asked my doctor is, can I record our conversations? Because I'm not going to remember this stuff. And my family was mostly in Jamaica at the time. So when I was going, it was me. My first meeting, it was just me. After that, my mom came and my daughter. My mom came from Jamaica and stayed with me, and my daughter and her would come with me to treatments and to everything. But I'm sure they were in a state of disbelief. We just lost my sister 6 months after we lost our dad. So it was just a lot. So I asked if I could record the conversation. She said yes. So in terms of looking for information about the cancer, I have another sister who did all of that research for me because I didn't want to know. I just wanted to know that I'm getting the drugs and that it's going to kill the cancer and then I'm going to be fine. Mm-hmm. That was my focus. I didn't want anything negative. So she did all of that and would sometimes if she saw something, she'd say, how about you check on that? How about you check on this? But I did a lot of recordings of conversations. I would go back and listen, and then I would write my questions down and ask them at the next visit.
That's really smart. I think that's something anybody listening could take away because you are getting so much information at those appointments. It can be so overwhelming. I think even if you are listening really closely, you do miss things. So to go back and listen and then write down your questions, it's a really good way to make sure you are getting all your questions covered and advocating for yourself in the next appointment or the next time you speak with your provider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, most people are so worried about capturing the information in the moment. And we always talk about having more than one person there. So more than one person can help you capture what's being said. But you're right, recording it, you're able to sit down calmly and quietly and listen to the conversation and be able to write your questions down in a thoughtful way.
When you're going through treatment, sometimes you can't write. Your hands hurt. And if you have family members and they're hearing all this stuff, it's foreign to them. They don't know what is important, what to write down quickly. It's too much.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much. That's so I'm glad I thought of that.
That's a great point.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Is there any other resources like that you recommend to the people that you connect with through your mentoring?
Yes. So one of the things, I have a few things that I normally recommend. The first thing, as everybody who is in this space know, is to make sure you go to a sarcoma center. First thing, high volume sarcoma center, not just one that sees one patient every 5 years. I also suggest that they ask questions, and if they don't understand, ask the provider to speak to them like they're a five-year-old. Break it all the way down so you know what they're saying. And if you have questions, don't be afraid to ask them. There are no stupid questions. And I also suggest that they ask for help. Like, I had a difficult time asking for help or accepting help in the beginning, like really hard, because it made me feel like I was giving up my autonomy and it made me feel like I was sick. Now, I was sick, but I didn't want to feel like I was sick.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone offered to help me, like my mom was there and she would offer to do something, I'm like, no, I can do that myself. And even when I was struggling, could barely move, I still wanted to do it myself because for me, that was me showing myself that I was surviving. But it's counterproductive. So it makes you more sick when you fight to do things that you really can't manage. So I suggest that they ask for help or accept help. Another thing, I try to encourage them to be positive. Because when you're positive and you have a positive mindset, you feel better. Even when your body isn't feeling great, your mind feels a little better and it helps. I was saying to Tasha earlier that I also did music therapy, art therapy. The art therapy that I chose was beading. So I started to make jewelry. And making the jewelry seem really simple, but it's not. It takes a level of focus to get those beads on those strings and to design them and all that. So I did a lot of art therapy and then I would give them away, give the beads, the jewelry away. people started to say, they're so nice, you should sell them. I tried to sell them, but I couldn't. It felt wrong to sell them, so I would give them away. I also did photography with my cell phone. I did a lot of macro photography where I would go outside when there weren't a lot of people around anywhere. I would go to my treatment and you would see me bending down and people would look at me like I was crazy, but I saw a tiny flower right there and I wanted to capture it and I wanted it to be big so you can see all of the petals and all of the little things inside. And it was amazing because you get to see the actual flower, not just a little speck on the ground. I shared some of those pictures on social media, but I didn't really say that this is what I was going through while I was doing it. I also love sunrises and sunsets. So let me just move out of the way a little bit. I have, can you see that one there?
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
That's one of my pictures. Yes. So I take a lot of those as well. And I take flowers. Anywhere I go, I take pictures of flowers or anything that looks a little bit beauty. I infuse my life with beauty and beautiful things.
Yeah. I love that. I infuse my life with beauty and beautiful things.
But because it makes you feel good. And if you feel good, then your body's going to react well.
I love the way you talked about that, because I think there's the notion of, you know, be positive. And it's hard sometimes to find ways to be positive when you feel so awful or when you're going through something so hard and overwhelming. And these are such tangible ways to, like you said, infuse beauty into your life. It isn't always just thinking positively. It's taking these beautiful things and practicing them, and it flows into your mindset. But for listeners who can't see, behind Margaret is a beautiful photo of a sunset, which you took that photo.
Yes.
It's gorgeous.
In 2022, I decided that I was done. Couldn't do this anymore. I'm tired. It's too much. And it keeps coming back. And every time it comes back, I have to deal with all this stuff, emotional stuff. I can't get to work. I'm now living on 40% of my normal earnings. I had to move away from my family because I couldn't afford to live in that area anymore. Move somewhere totally foreign to me that I hated. And I just decided I'm done. And then my daughter got pregnant. And I decided that, you know, I can't be done. I want my granddaughter to know me. I had two before, and I wanted this one to know me too. And I didn't want her to just know me through pictures and videos. I want her to have experiences with her grandmother. Because my grandmother was my favorite person in the entire world. My maternal grandmother. And I always said I want all of my grandchildren to feel the way I felt about her, about me. So I was able to push through a lot. Because I had her there. From she was born. And she's still giving me. She still gives me joy. She's three. She's about to be four in a few months. She gives me so much joy and gives me a reason to keep pushing through. So if you have someone that you love or you can focus on, just find something that, you know, makes your life worth living. It doesn't have to be a person. It can be a thing. It can be an organization that you like that's doing something, and work with them. Anything. Because I do that as well. I find different organizations and offer my services. It helps. And when you're helping someone, even when you're going through your treatment, if you're able to talk to someone and encourage someone, it makes you feel so much stronger. Literally give you strength. Because I found that. Because I did mentoring even while I was going through my treatment. I've only ever turned away one person. And I literally couldn't manage. So that's another thing. You have to know your limitations as well and take care of you.
And speaking about finding organizations, you found SFA and now is a part of our public policy advisory committee as well, and helping us plan our upcoming advocacy weekend for July and sarcoma awareness month in July. And really now using your experience to help mentor us in a way and to give us feedback and ideas and guide us on, you know, issues that are important to people like you who are going through this. So we really appreciate that you're part of our family as well.
Thank you.
And 2 days ago, something popped in my head. And I just got up and decided to do a Google search of gynecology associations and started reaching out to them to say, listen, we need to let gynecologists know that this cancer is out there and that you may not see it. It may not be a part of their language because a lot of the times they don't know the name. And I feel like if more gynecologists know that this is out there, they will look at fibroids in a different light and it will save lives.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that because we did have another guest with LMS on our podcast, and her story was very different than yours. Her doctor did think about it from the very beginning, and her doctor said to her, I think this is probably just fibroids, but in the off chance it could be this very rare cancer called sarcoma, we're going to treat it like it's sarcoma from the beginning. And so her journey was very different. So that is a great example of what you just said. If we can grow awareness about this, then more doctors will enter the conversation, the initial conversation, thinking, okay, it's probably this, but it could be this. So why don't we just think like it could, that it's this, and we can treat it as such. And if it's not, we haven't lost anything.
Exactly. Exactly. And I heard that podcast, but it still didn't click to me that I could do something about it until I heard that lady. Because whenever I hear of a new diagnosis, and I have a new support group that I started for Black women with sarcoma cancer, because I noticed that our voices are very, very hidden. We don't talk about it. And so I decided to start that. I spoke with my doctor and she said, you're absolutely correct. Because I said to her at first, is it that we don't get it as much? And she said, no, it's equal across the board. And I'm like, but everywhere I go, I see my Caucasian sisters and they're talking about it, but I don't see the African-American people. And she said, I find that they don't really like to talk about it. So I said, you know what? If you want to see a difference, then you make the difference. You want to see something done, then you make us, you start it. So I started it last October and I'm getting a few people. And every time I hear of a new diagnosis, it breaks my heart. It literally breaks my heart. But, and I find something else to do to make a difference. So I have a letter that I wrote to one of the organizations. I'm planning to send it to all of them. I have one of my group members. She's 37. She was diagnosed in August. And her doctor said to her, Black women don't have this. Yes. Black women don't have this disease. And it's very unlikely that you're going to survive. And the moment I heard that, I said to her, listen, lady, you have to leave her right now. And you have to find a sarcoma center. And she didn't leave immediately because it's the best and she's a gynecologist and she has good reviews and all of that. And I said, you have to leave her. It took a while before she left. And she is trying to get onto some clinical trials because her situation has gotten really, really dire. It's gotten bad.
What can we do to get information in the hands of people who need it?
Okay.
That may be different than the way we're doing it now.
I did an infographic last year for myself for sarcoma awareness day. And I posted, I took it down real quick. I didn't leave it there for very long.
Why? Take it down.
Because it felt so, it's very personal. Because I even have the scar, a picture of me with the scar, not my face, but just the scar. But the reason I removed it or I hid it, because it's still on there, it's just hidden. Because that really bothers me. When they start treating you like you're an invalid, I'm still here. I'm walking around. I may not be able to walk far. I may have to sit down for a minute. But I'm doing it.
You're still a person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's the reason that we launched this podcast.
Right.
And the feedback that we're getting about this podcast, people want to hear from other people who are going through the same journey. And it's not in a it helps to inspire them. It helps to help them the same way you were helped in the beginning from other people. It helps to let them know they're not alone in their journey. It helps to let them know that other people are experiencing some of the exact same things I'm experiencing, or they're very similar, and I'm not alone. That is the theme that keeps coming up. So while it is scary to put yourself out there, and while it is intimidating to put yourself out there, know that other people are truly benefiting from that. And people need people to be courageous. Think about that when you wonder if it will be impactful, or you wonder about putting it out there. Maybe you look at, I'm doing this for other people. So while I'm afraid, I'm doing it for others.
Yeah. And I do it, and then I pull it back, which is a little bit sad. My fingers, since I was a child, I always had pretty fingers. And then when I had my treatment, the first one, my nail lifted off the nail bed. You could put something all the way down to the end. And then my fingers were so black, like literally like charcoal. And then the rest of my hand was my regular color. And I was so ashamed of my hands. I literally was ashamed for people to see my hands. And one morning I woke up and I heard a voice say to me, Margaret, you need to share this. There are people who need it. They need to see that your hands are back to normal. And I'm like, no, thank you. I'm not doing that. I'm not sharing that picture. No, I'm not. And it took almost a week for me to share that picture on the internet, because I shared a story with it. I didn't just put the pictures there. I shared the story and I shared the struggle that it took everything in me to post this. Mm-hmm. And then after I gave it a couple of weeks, and then I hit it as well. So it's not always there. Because I feel like I don't want to scare people either. I don't want people, every time they come on my page, to see something that scares them. So I have two Instagram accounts, one for sarcoma. I call it Fight Like a Lioness, which is the name of my group. Oh. I remember saying to someone on a prayer line a couple of weeks ago that I'm so happy that my, you know that song that says, my living shall not be in vain? That my living is not in vain. Because sometimes you feel guilty for surviving this when there's so many younger people who haven't had any life experiences that lose their lives. And you're like, but I've had my children, I've seen grandchildren, I've done this, I've done that, and that person didn't get to do much. And you feel guilty. And being able to give back and help means that I'm not just here randomly. Yeah. It means that my living is worth something because I'm doing something, helping people. This life, we keep moving and we keep staying grateful.
Margaret, I think the topic of survivor's guilt is something we haven't really talked about a lot on the podcast, but it is, I know, something anybody with sarcoma, with any type of cancer, without it, feels. And I'm glad you brought it up just in this conversation, because it's a duality, I think, of embracing this life that you've been given and also grappling with the guilt that comes along with that. It's a very real thing. You have to really put in the effort some days to combat that and also remain grateful. It's not easy.
So you mentioned the support group that you have started. What is the name of it? When do people meet? How can people get involved?
Okay, so I started in October of last year, a support group for Black women with sarcoma cancer. And I call it the Fight Like a Lioness. And one of the reasons I chose that name, and I also had, before I even decided on the group, I had an Instagram page, and that was the name I have on there, Fight Like a Lioness. And that came from my second recurrence in 2020, when I had some really, really rough days. And there was a lady that went to high school with me who would send me little encouraging words. And she called me Lioness. I don't know why. I've never asked her why she decided to call me that. But she would say things and she would call me Lioness and say, Lioness, I'm thinking about you. Keep fighting, things like that. But every time I read the word Lioness, I felt extra strength, literally. It resonated. It felt so personal. It felt like it was me. And that's the reason I chose that name, is to give strength. Because we know that the lioness are the really strong ones, not the lions. They're the ones that fight. They're the ones that hunt. They're the ones that take care of the family. So, yeah, that's the reason I chose that.
That's a great name. I love that name.
Thank you.
Earlier in the discussion, you mentioned the lack of awareness among Black women. So I don't know if there are things that you've learned throughout your journey or the work that you do that you could share with others to educate them about.
Okay. So one of the things I found is that we tend to have fibroids a lot. And we don't tend to take care of it, because a lot of the times what I hear is the doctors say, oh, it's not bothering you, so don't worry about it. I've heard from Caucasian women where, oh, you have a fibroid, let's get rid of it. So I can't say, make a blanket statement to say that's what happens to everybody or everywhere. But I've had that experience where they tell you, oh, don't worry about it. If it's not bothering you, don't bother it. But on the other side, they say, oh, let's get rid of it. So that's one thing. I also find that my African-American sisters are less likely to want to do the surgery. A lot of them will say, oh, I'm in my 40s. It's coming up to menopause. And they say, once I get to menopause, it's going to start shrinking. So they don't want to do anything. I try to encourage people to take care of themselves. And I'm going to say that I would like to apologize if I trigger anyone with this comment, but it's been my experience. A lot of times we walk into somebody's office, and if we're not wearing a suit and we're not fully made up, we're not seen as worth having a conversation with. We're not seen as intelligent. I had to tell one of my medical care professionals early in this journey that because I cannot walk with my MBA across my forehead doesn't mean I'm stupid. You don't know what my education level is when I walk into your office. Because I'm in a jeans and t-shirt, it doesn't mean I'm stupid. So do not speak to me like I'm stupid. So we get that a lot, where they just assume that you're not intelligent or educated just based on how you look. And I find that very offensive. I'm like, I address it every single time I encounter it. I don't let it pass. And normally after that, we have really great relationships.
Well, that goes back to the self-advocacy as well. Because you do have to speak up for yourself.
Exactly.
You are the person going through it. You should be a team with your medical professional. And when you are not, that may not be the medical professional for you. And you have to speak up for yourself, regardless of the situation that you're in. And, you know, the doctors are there to be our partner. The medical professionals are there to be our partners.
Exactly.
It is the patient's decision how they maneuver their journey.
Exactly. 100%. And I say that all the time. It is my body. So I have a right to be a part of the decision making. I say it to everybody who goes through. You know, there's one other thing I'd like to address. Mm-hmm. I'd like to address the caregivers, because I am finding, this wasn't my experience, but my family is a little different. we're a small unit, so we tend to do things as a unit. Even though we are scattered now, we still do things as a unit. But I'm finding that we have some of our patients who are going through this disease, and they have caregivers who are pushing them to do different things that are not what they want to do. Like, don't do the chemo because it's not working. why don't you try this homeopathic remedy? Why don't you do this? All of these things are coming at them. They're at their lowest, emotionally, physically, mentally. They're at their lowest. Ask a question. Listen. Don't just keep forcing things. And every day you bring a new remedy. Every day you bring a new remedy. That is annoying and distressing because you are not a sarcoma doctor. So you can't say, oh, my friend with breast cancer stopped eating this and her cancer shrunk. It's not the same. It really is not the same. And you have to be more aware and be more supportive.
That is something that I have talked about in my own personal journey, and something that resonates so much with me, because I've talked about this a lot with my own personal journey to our team at SFA, also with friends and family, when my mom was going through it. And I think I mentioned this on another episode, when my mom was going through it, I call it being the coach. I'm the coach. Right. I'm the caregiver, but I'm also the coach. And I try to coach her to eat and, you know, eat this and not that. And I read this and, you know, and you want to be educated so you can make good decisions. I learned it after the fact of you don't have to be the coach. You have to be the support. And those are two very, very different things, two very different things. And really listening to and Natasha talks even better about this. Of letting someone else lead. And sometimes as caregivers, you know, we get into the mode of got to track everything. I've got to move everything. I got to be that coach, be that organizer. You're supporting and you're pushing. And sometimes that's not what the patient needs.
Yeah. Well, Margaret said it best with listen, because I think to find where the patient is leading, you have to listen to the patient. And I always use the example of a friend in my personal journey where in hindsight, after I finished treatment, was like, why was she so supportive? And we had a conversation about it where she said, I let you lead. I just followed what you were doing. I followed the way you were speaking about your diagnosis. I followed the resources that you were telling me about. And I just followed your lead. And I was like, wow, that made a big difference. I had no idea you were doing that.
I have two friends who walked this journey with me, like really walked this journey with me. And I remember when I had the second recurrence in 2020, I called and I said, listen, this is what is happening. It's back. But I have some, you have to decide if you're going to walk with me or not. And if you decide that you want to walk with me, there are some things that you can't do. You can't cry. You can't have any negative emotion. Now I'm telling the people how to feel, right? You can't have any negative emotions, because if you have negative emotions, you're putting it out into the universe and it's going to come back to me. So you can't have those. If you find that they're coming to you, just stop. No crying, no drama. We're fighting. I'm putting on my armor and I'm going to fight, and that's it. So we're not going to do all the emotional stuff. No emotions are going to be in this. I told them that. And I have, it was a male and a female. The female laughs about it all the time because she's a crier. And she said, every time I wanted to cry, she said, one day I just bawled. And I called the guy and I said to him, you know, I really cried. And he said, you can't do that. Margaret said, we can't do that.
That's so funny. I told everyone, I said, if you're going to cry, you do it outside of my room.
The first time I was okay with that. The second time, no. No crying. No crying. And do you know what that, no. To be honest, though, it has caused me to have an actual issue because I completely shut my emotions down. So for the past few years, I have a hard time feeling like something will happen and I'd be so happy about it, but I don't feel the joy coming out. So I'm in therapy and my therapist is working with me through it. But I literally shut down every single emotion so I could walk this walk and come out on the other side.
We've talked about therapy in a few episodes, and I wonder if you could share how you got connected to your therapist. Was it through your institution or how did you get connected?
There are different ways to do it. That's what I'm thinking, because I had options through my the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me a therapist, but that didn't work out for us because I ended up not trusting them because they offered me medication and we discussed dosage and things like that. And then they secretly tried to give me another dose because they thought it was better for me. So because of that, I had to cancel them, because immediately you can't start a relationship based on mistrust. I got my therapist through my insurance. I had one before and we had an issue, and I needed someone right then and there. So I called the insurance company and asked them for options, and they gave me some. And that's how I found the lady that I have today, who is an amazing therapist.
That's great.
I give you the space to talk about mistrust, because I hear you talk about this and that being a theme in the Black community. And so I want to give you the space to comment on mistrust in the medical field, if you'd like.
Yes, I will. I will. Because one of my members of the support group literally spoke about that this past Tuesday. I don't have the history that my African-American counterparts have, because I grew up in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Mine just came from experiencing doctors who thought they knew everything and wanted to push things on my throat to say, this is what you have to do, without listening to what my issue is properly. That's where my mistrust came from. But people here have a real problem with it. One of my support group sisters has a parent who doesn't trust the doctors at all. Literally doesn't trust them. So she's trying to do clinical trials, and he's telling her, do you remember what they did with those people back then? I don't think that's a safe thing for you to do. They're using you as a guinea pig. It's not okay. I don't want you to do it. She wants to do it, but he doesn't want her to do it, because she understands. She's a young person, and she understands that this is probably her only option right now. But he's fighting tooth and nail for her not to do it. And trying, he's even tried to get her different options, like herbs and things like that, that he thinks will help. And one of the things he said to her, if you're going to do a clinical trial, why don't you look at the herbs that this person is offering as a clinical trial? And we had a whole discussion about that and why that doesn't make sense.
It's a very real fear, though, based on history.
It's an important barrier to clinical trials or to patients getting access to treatment.
Yes.
That needs to be talked about and needs to be addressed so that everyone is included and getting the treatment that they need when they've gotten a sarcoma diagnosis.
I remember when COVID hit and Black people didn't want to take the shot. And I had friends who didn't want to take the shot based on that same thing. You just have to be sensible. You have to analyze things. Don't just go based on, oh, I heard that.
You know, it's challenging because we do have a lack of representation in our clinical trials now, which we need to change, right? Yeah. Developing therapies that are inclusive of everyone and everyone's experience and how they impact everyone is really important to our future work. You know, and the research, but there are barriers to that need to be overcome.
I think if we have small group discussions, don't know if people are going to be open to actually being a part of the discussions, but I think it might work. It might help. Like this morning, I went to a Zoom meeting where they were discussing clinical trials. I thought it was going to be about sarcoma, but it wasn't. It was a lung cancer group that was doing it. But it doesn't matter who it is. I think having open discussions and seeing people of color being a part of the science community will help. Because if I see you when you look like me, I'm going to find it easier to trust you. So yeah. I think that's one option.
Absolutely.
It's very true. I'm glad you shared that, because I think this is an opportunity to have that important discussion. So an education moment. I think that's an important topic. And I think that requires a lot of further discussion on those issues to grow that awareness and to grow that representation and help overcome some of those barriers. It has to happen. And that representation is so important.
Recently, like yesterday, I saw it's Black History Month. So you have people who are posting different things. And they show a lady on a table with some men around her. And whoever the guy who they call the father of gynecology is, they said that he did, I don't remember how many surgeries, it was in double digits though, how many surgeries on her without any kind of anesthetic or anything. And that he did, it did help in terms of healthcare. But when you see this as someone who is, who you can identify with, that's me on that table. And then you go somewhere and someone who looks like that man who did that is offering your clinical trial. Even if you're not consciously thinking about it, your brain is going to go there. Your brain might, something in the back of your mind might just be a little cautious. So you're going to have to learn to communicate more and just build trust. It's going to take time. It's going to take time to build that trust. But in my group, we have 5 people right now, and 2 of them are open. One was on a clinical trial. One was signed up for 2 that didn't work out. So I was very, very happy about that, to see that they're so open to it. So I think it's changing. Yeah.
But you're right, though, that those conversations have to happen for it to change.
We were supposed to talk an hour. Oh my God, it's almost 2 hours.
Sorry.
I have to keep extending these calendar invites because we do often spend 2 hours talking. But let's ask our last question, though. Margaret, is there anything else you want to share with the community? Is there any last advice you want to share with our listeners?
Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask your doctors the questions. Don't be afraid to go online and look for answers. Facebook has multiple groups that address sarcoma. And the people on the group are very open because they're going through it or have gone through it or have family members who have gone through it. So they're very open and very helpful. So look for those resources would be my final advice.
That's good advice. And we ask everybody this question to finish, but if listeners in the community would like to connect with you, where can they find you?
As I said before, I'm on Instagram, Fight Like a Lioness. I'm on Facebook, my normal name, Margaret Livermore. And that's pretty much it. I don't have a lot of social media, just those 2. I have LinkedIn, but I haven't been on there for a few years.
Well, we will link your Instagram handle in our notes of the podcast. And we'll also link our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, which, Margaret, I believe you're a part of.
Yes,
I am. So people can connect with you on there as well.
Okay.
Which is great.
And also on our Facebook group, we'll share information about your support group.
Yeah, we'll link it in the group because I think there are just so many great ways to connect with you and opportunities to continue the conversation with you outside of the podcast. So,
okay.
Again, Margaret, thank you so much for this conversation today. It's just, you know, wonderful to have you here, but I think a very necessary conversation, and just really appreciative of how much openness and honesty you've shared today. So thank you.
It's good to see you. Thank you so much for your honesty and for the conversation that we were able to have today. I really appreciate it. It was very helpful to educate me as well. And yeah. So I really appreciate us being able to have this really genuine, authentic conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.